This is an interview for the SEC Historical Society's online virtual archive on the history of financial regulation. Today is April 1st, 2011. I'm James Stoker. I'm talking today with Sean O'Malley. Sean has had a long career in which he has seen the accounting profession grow and develop from many different sides. 36 years, I believe, at Pricewaterhouse, culminating in 7 years as senior partner, 3 years as trustee and then president of the Financial Accounting Foundation, which oversees the FASB and the GASB. And finally, in the business world, where he has served on a number of corporate boards of directors and internal audit boards. Welcome, Sean.
It's good to be here.
So to begin with, where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Philadelphia, and I grew up here. I was the fifth of eight children, and stayed here and always came back after being away. Serving with the firm and with the U.S. Army. I've lived in Texas, I've lived in Germany, I've lived in Japan, but I always keep coming back. And, of course, New York for two different times for a total of over 10 years.
You attended the University of Philadelphia here, right?
No, University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, Pennsylvania, excuse
Penn,
me.
Penn, yes, the Wharton School at Penn is where I went to college.
I understand that you started as an English major.
I did. That was my fervent hope, and the family finances being what they were, I felt I had to contribute. My father died fairly young, and so I had younger siblings at the time. So I came back to Penn. I went in the service to get the GI Bill, which helped pay for my college then. And then when I came back from the service, I switched over to the Wharton School.
What did you do in the service?
Well, I was in the Ordnance Corps, and I spent about 9 months at Fort Bliss, Texas, and then our whole unit was sent to Germany for the last year or so of the occupation following World War II.
Where were you stationed in Germany?
I was stationed in a little village called Gonsenheim, which was right next to Mainz. It was in the French zone, so that there hadn't been a lot invested in rebuilding in the French zone, as you might imagine. But it was a wonderful experience for me, both the Army and service in Europe.
So after the Army, you came back and you continued your studies at the Wharton School?
I switched over to the Wharton School when I came back, because I had done a semester in the college before I went into service, and switched to the Wharton School.
Tell me about your studies there. How did they prepare you for a career in accounting?
Well, the Wharton School curriculum is a broad-based one, even back then, although there are courses I took that would never be given today, such as a course in industry you had to take, which studied like about 20 industries, one every week, you know, steel, oil, manufacturing, textiles, everything. So you, and including brokerages and so on. So you got a smattering of every kind of industry in America, courses like that. But they also had statistics, lots of accounting, because I was an accounting major, which in itself was unusual. I knew nothing about business going into this time when I switched to Wharton. I just felt I had to be there so I could earn an amount of money to help the family. And so they asked me at the outset, well, would you like to declare a major? And I said, I really don't know enough about business to do that. And they said, well, you can change if you want, but why don't you just give us an inclination? So I knew I needed to have some discipline in study. So I said, well, what's your toughest major? And he said, accounting. And I said, okay, well, put me down for accounting. And I could have changed it, but to me it was really a very logical subject, and I took to it very easily. So
that's how you got into accounting. Did you have any professors there that influenced you?
Yes, I had some. Sad to say, most of them have gone on to their eternal reward, but Dick Woods was a professor there, fairly well known, and he taught me two different courses, one in systems and I believe one in auditing. But you had to take like 30 hours of accounting over the 4 year period. So there was a full boat. Actually, I spent a lot of time thinking about what liberal arts course I would take each semester. And I had some great professors there in history and in English, so it all worked out well.
So after the Wharton School, how did you come to join Price Waterhouse?
Well, being an accounting major, it was obvious that the right step would be to go to an accounting firm. So I interviewed probably four of the then big eight, and I was most impressed with the interviewer and with his the way he conducted the interview, the fellow from Price Waterhouse. And so he made me an offer, and I accepted it.
Did an accounting student at this time often have a choice of job offers, or was it difficult to get a position at this time?
I would think so. If you did reasonably well, and if you did well in the interview process, I think I could have gone to any of the four firms. Mm-hmm. I chose PW because I was just impressed. I was also interested in international, and I mentioned that in the interview, and he told me what the opportunities might be, and that too impressed me. But yeah, we all went in with our hat in our hand, but really it wasn't just a buyer's market. It was a good situation. There was openings and there were plenty of candidates.
What were your first years at Price Waterhouse like?
Lots of hard work. You had 8 weeks. I think it was 8 weeks, the initial training course, and then you went right out onto your first audit. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a junior accountant, and then we were growing at the time because the economy was growing and lots of new business was coming in. So I was able to move ahead. I became a first assistant and then a senior accountant in 3 years, which was a little faster than the norm at that time. And then I became a manager after 5 years, which too was, but it wasn't just me, several people moved at that rate. But it was always very interesting. But you had to commit to working very hard. I once worked like 47 days in a row. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was a bachelor. And so I think they figured, it's not like he has kids at home and a wife. And so, but I didn't mind it. I was still interested, so.
Did Price Waterhouse have a consulting business at this time or offer non-audit services?
Yes, they had a which was called an MAS department, and it was not that large. I would say in Philadelphia, when I joined the staff in 1959, we had a total, the whole staff was about 120 people, and I think there was about five people in management advisory services, and two of them had started out on the audit staff moved over there. So,
did you work with consultants on the same projects at all, or was their work completely separate?
In those days, completely separate. I mean, there was always a suspicion. Typical. We were auditors. We were suspicious of the tax department, and they were suspicious of us. It was sort of a like in a team, like an athletic team. What are they doing? That sort of thing. But we got along with everybody, but we would kid each other, and it was the early times for the consulting group.
In those first years at Price Waterhouse, was George May still around?
He was, I believe, still alive, or else he had died. I don't know when he actually died, but we were conscious of George O'May, and I was conscious of the history of the firm and the role that he played.
Were the repercussions of the McKesson-Robbins scandal still being felt at this time from the 1930s?
I would say no. That had totally been, in other words, everybody throughout the profession now was observing inventories as a regular part of the audit process. and confirmation of receivables was a very accepted and necessary step. So it wasn't, no, it was nothing. You had studied it in school in auditing some of the big cases, but it had no particular impact.
So you worked in the Philadelphia office, and then in your early career, you also spent time overseas in Tokyo and Osaka.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was an interesting situation because the firm had just had had correspondents, several correspondent offices in Japan, and an agreement had been reached so that these correspondents would now become part of the international firm, and their name would change to Price Waterhouse. Well, right away, lots of American subsidiary companies, once the name Price Waterhouse was on there, they were dealing with us, they would want the same level of service and the same just arrangement as they had. So the Japanese in those days prepared their financial statements along the traditional English method. The balance sheet was a little different, and the disclosures were not that great, to be honest. So my job when I went there was, I was a young manager, was to work with the managers in the Tokyo office, all of whom were Japanese. And so I would take their audit report and financial statements, maybe of the prior year or the current year if it was in draft, and tailor it, rearrange it in the U.S. format for all U.S. subs, and which included writing footnotes to cover a lot of information that was required in the U.S. Even though it was not required in Japan, the parent companies in the U.S. Wanted that information. And so I got to know most of the managers in the office by doing that. It was very challenging. And I visited a few clients where we had to have an interpreter there to have a discussion. So, but it was very interesting.
Did your Japanese counterparts speak English?
Yes, in varying degrees. And I had a tutor teaching me spoken Japanese three nights a week. She would come to our hotel and spend an hour or so drilling me in Japanese.
Oh, that's very impressive, huh? So you spent about a year there, is that correct?
No, about 6 months.
Oh, it was only 6 months. Okay, good. And then you came back and worked in Philadelphia for a while, and
yes.
Then you transferred to the New York office.
Yes. In those days, as you moved along, and maybe you were thinking about becoming a partner at some point, they sent you to the research department in New York for 2 years. And it was a wonderful experience. The first year, you worked on what they called day-to-day, but it was really client accounting research. And so all offices in the fields could call in with a thorny problem where they wanted some consultation or advice. There was about five or six of us managers in that role, and we would report to two different partners who were full-time in that and say, this is, you tell them what you thought the solution was, and then they would tell you whether they agreed, and they'd ask you to go back and do more research. And then the second year, you spent, in those days, each of the major firms, each of the eight firms had a member on the accounting principles board, the APB, and so you were supporting that member. You were doing what was called long range. You would be researching problems and supporting him, doing research that he asked for, and it was about developing principles. And I remember there's a paragraph or two, and I think it's APB 16 that I actually drafted. You know, so you were really close. You're really close to the process. And a lot of problems were solved, at least temporarily solved, by the APB in those days. They got earnings per share, mergers and acquisitions, leases, several other issues were dealt with, and pronouncements were made. And so that was an interesting time to be in that job.
Mm-hmm. So this was a time when they were working on the purchase versus
pooling
controversy.
Yes.
What position did Pricewaterhouse take on that?
Pricewaterhouse accepted pooling. None of the firms really spoke out in eliminating pooling of interest, perhaps tightening it up because it was getting a little, in practice, you could see there were some poolings that probably shouldn't have been poolings, but met what was then considered to be the letter of the law. Mm-hmm. So that eventually, of course, pooling went out the window.
Yeah. These were the final years of the APB, of course. People at Pricewaterhouse concerned about the future of the profession because the professional standards bodies were having so much trouble?
Well, will you say, were they worried about the profession? No, they were worried about the way the principles were formed. And I think all the firms got behind the FASB at its outset and felt that it was truly an independent group and that maybe it would work better than the APB. Although, if you go back and look at the history of the APB and the issues they dealt with and the problems they solved, I think they deserve a pat on the back.
So in 1970, you made partner?
Yes.
And you came back to Philadelphia?
Yes.
Good. And what sorts of issues did you work on throughout the 1970s?
You mean when I came back to
Yes.
Philadelphia?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, initially, they assigned me to a number of medium and smaller clients, although my experience in the firm in the early years had been on major, large clients. So when I came back, and I think some of the partners were asked, were there any client they would prefer that I be handling? And so I ended up with, let me put it this way, my first year at the annual golf outing party, the managers in the office presented me with a framed copy of a clean opinion because I had issued so many opinions with exceptions and some going concern opinions and so on. So they challenged me. But at that time, I was probably at the peak of my technical capability after my experience before and then the 2 years in research. So I was pretty strong technically, and so I was able to deal with these. And I enjoyed the clients. Mm-hmm.
In 1973, under pressure from the FTC and the Justice Department, the AICPA lifted the ban on competitive bidding between accounting firms. How did that impact the accounting industry?
Well, I thought that was, you know, a terrible thing, because what it did, it said, your code of ethics, put it in the wastebasket. And, you know, we were always taught that ethics was a very strong part of being a professional and that we should abide by them. So now all of a sudden it was like a market was sort of dog eat dog. It was go after other people's clients, do all kinds of things like that.
So you saw a change in your own office?
Yeah, I mean, competition started happening, and you became aware if other firms were ringing the doorbell at your client or trying to ease in through one way or another, often to get some kind of an assignment and then leverage it into getting the whole thing. And so it became a lot more competitive profession. And frankly, I did not appreciate it. I thought it diminished the profession, but you had to live with that. That was the way it was.
So in 1979, you became partner in charge at the Philadelphia office.
Is that when it was?
Yeah.
I guess. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How did your duties change then?
Well, and I was always a client service person. I always thought that was the key role of of anyone in the firm, including partners. And I did not like the idea of lots of partners spending full time on administrative matters, although that becomes a necessity eventually. But I maintained the client, sort of setting a good example. While I was in charge of the office, I always had a client who I would be responsible for that audit. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting time. We were still in a growth, although there was some, you know, ups and downs. But and we made some new partners. We had a good office. We had always had a good office that believed in itself. My predecessor, a guy named Jack O'Hara, was famous throughout the firm. He was very gung-ho. He was Harvard Business School graduate. And he was extremely loyal to his people. He supported you totally. He also demanded a lot of you. And so that was a good example for anyone to be heading up an office. And I didn't have the same personality as Jack. Nobody did. But he was a good mentor to step into that job.
In 1984, you joined the company's policy board.
Yes.
What did the policy board do?
Policy board is essentially the board of directors of the firm. And it was a an electoral process would be a committee of partners would go around and interview as many partners wanted to be. They would go to an office. Anyone could sign up to be interviewed. Oftentimes, like when you were a young partner, you wouldn't know any of the potential candidates, so you might decline to be interviewed. Or else sometimes you would just say, well, this is a type of person I'd like to see. We need somebody who's this, that, or the other. So that process had taken place, and three of us, there were three openings, and three of us were nominated. And it was really odd and somewhat humorous in that the three people who were nominated this year were John O'Malley, Matt O'Rourke, and John O'Brien. Three O's.
Somebody liked the letter O, apparently.
Yeah. One of them was in Cleveland, and one was in San Francisco, and I was in Philadelphia. And so we joined the policy board.
Okay. And did that take up a lot of your time, your duties?
Yes, well, yeah, it took up a fair amount. I mean, I don't know, maybe 15% of your time, because you had to go to meetings.
Were the meetings in New York usually?
Yes.
Okay.
So you were just about always in New York, because that's where the leadership of the firm was in the national office. And but you also had to serve on committees, and one of them was the admissions committee, which required you to go out and interview partners in various offices about a candidate that they had put up for a partner. And then you had to dig into his credentials and so on, and then report back. The admissions committee would then report back to the full policy board when they were voting on new partners. And that's so important, because you're making a huge decision for each partner. If the partner is 35 years old and your retirement age is 60, you're taking this person on for a 25-year contract, sort of, at rather substantial numbers. So you better be careful about who you're making. So we were very careful about who became a partner. And you always, no matter how hard you tried, you always made some mistakes. I mean, you would turn down someone who later you would say you should have taken X, or and I hope this happened less, you would take X and later think maybe that wasn't the best move. But the process was such that I would say 99.5% of the time we got the answer right.
Well, that's a pretty good ratio. Good success rate. In 1984, there was discussion of a possible merger with Deloitte, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. What happened there? And were you involved in that at all, or was that before you joined the board?
No, I was. Well, it had started before I joined the board, the discussions. And I had spoken out before this happened and said, you know, we don't want to be the last person on the block. This is going to happen. There's going to be consolidation in the profession, and we should be aggressive in looking at what we want to do. And so I had said that before anybody knew what was going on, you know, quiet discussion. So in my first policy board meeting, I know the senior partner then said they were in these discussions and nearing the finish line, and it was sort of, so see, we were doing it, you know.
So you didn't know about that before you joined the policy board?
No, and then basically what happened is the UK firm, which was the strongest, US and the UK were the two strongest firms in the network. They, and we had said we couldn't go forward unless we had, I think it was the five largest and strongest firms. That would be the US, the UK, Europe, South America, and Australia. And so the UK backed off and said no. And that absolutely, because that was a condition that must be followed, it just didn't happen. So,
at this time, you also served on the World Firms Council of Partners and on its General Council.
That's right.
Okay. Did you join those at the same time as the policy board, or was that at a different
time? I think
time?
A year later or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or I might have, maybe I was on the World Firm Council before I even went on the policy board.
Right.
And that was an interesting, because you met a couple times a year, and there were partners from every firm. There might be, say it was 50 people in the council, there might be five from the U.S., four from the U.K., but every firm had at least one. And you would meet a couple of times, and you would have various breakout groups and discuss particular problems or issues and what you thought ought to be done, and then the council would come together and summarize what had been discussed and agreed upon, and recommend something to the world board to approve this, that, or the other things. And it was, the other part of it was, you got to know people throughout. So I knew people from just about every firm around as a result of that experience. And I knew some from having sent them instructions to do a subsidiary of a company that I was in charge of. So it was an interesting, it had no real power, but it could recommend things to the world.
Where were these meetings? Did it rotate from year to year?
Yes. Don't ask me where. I think there was one I can remember in Canada. There was probably one in Europe. There might have been one in Asia.
And then in 1987, you were selected to be the new senior partner.
Correct.
Uh-huh. This was immediately after the savings and loan crisis, right?
Yes.
Yep. How did PW weather the savings and loan crisis?
Well, we basically were not strong in that particular interest, so it had almost... It had almost no effect on us. Mm-hmm. I can't name a single S&L of any significance that was, you could say we had missed the boat or something, but we didn't have many clients in that industry. We had a lot of big banks, but we didn't have S&Ls to any degree. So that crisis, other than the fact that it got people talking about audits again and everything, but it had no real effect on us, and certainly no financial effect on us.
Was that a conscious decision by Pricewaterhouse not to get involved in the savings and loan industry?
To some degree, on smaller savings and loans, yes. We did not look to get those as clients. Mm-hmm. And we felt the same way about casinos.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So tell me about the selection process for a senior partner. How does that work, and how did you get picked?
That's a good question. The way it works is the policy board appoints a nominating committee, or they announce this is going to be a nominating committee, and it's not members of the policy board; it's partners throughout the firm, and they make sure that every geographic area is represented and every discipline is represented, etc. And then they put that up to the partners, and the partners then approve that this should be the nominating committee. And if somebody wants to say, I want Joe Blow to be on that too, then that could be, if enough people agreed that Joe should be on there, and 25 people agreed, then they would take that back and they might add it. That never happened, where there was, you know, because it was such a good process that they made sure everyone felt they had young, old, audit, tax, MAS, everything was represented, in geography. So then they would go around in the same way. They would go to every office of the firm, not all of them, but, you know, different members of this nominating would go, and they would interview partners. Who do you think? At that time, the only ones who were eligible to become senior partner were members of the policy board. So that narrowed the field, but the partners had voted these people into the policy board. So then they would meet. After all these interviews, they would get together again, and for like a long weekend, or as long as it took, they used to joke about it, until the white smoke went up, and they would then decide. Now they established their own rules too, the nominating committee, when they first met, what they were going to do, how they were going to do it, and they would put forward to the partners. They could put several candidates, or in the history of the firm, the nominating committee had never put more than one person up. And before they went off, in this case it was in Chicago, for that long weekend to make the decision, they interviewed every of the candidates.
How many candidates were there?
Well, there probably were about six or seven who were on the policy board. Now, a couple of them took their name out early and told the I have no interest in, you know, sort of like a Calvin Coolidge. I don't wish to run. And so I thought once you were on the policy board, you had a responsibility to run, because since only policy board members were eligible. So, but I must tell you that I had no expectation that I would be the candidate. There was a couple of people that I thought.
There are even newspaper articles from the time that note that you weren't the front runner in the competition.
That's right. Yeah. And so I was actually out in Detroit, and I was interviewing the partners in Detroit about their proposals for new partners. And so as part of my responsibility on the admissions committee, when I got the call, and I was totally shocked, and I said, okay. And they said, you can't tell anybody, because we're not going to release this. And so it was coming up on Thanksgiving. They wanted to do it right after Thanksgiving. They said, but you could tell your wife. So I said, thanks. So I called my wife and told her. And then it pretty much, you know, there was a formal vote, but when there's only one candidate. So that started a whole new career.
Mm-hmm. So what were your priorities after becoming senior partner?
Well, globalization was starting, and so complete integration of the firms around the world was one of my things. As always, I said at the outset, client service was once again number one priority for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I actually established a chairman's client service award, which I gave quarterly. And the winner would get to come to New York, have lunch with me. I don't know whether that was a great reward. Oh, he also got a check. But it was just constantly emphasizing the importance of outstanding, excellent client service in every discipline. And, of course, globalization was key in strengthening the international operations. So I'd say those were the two principles. HR was very important in terms of both partners and non-partners, you know, professional staff.
Very soon after your selection as senior partner, you told the Wall Street Journal that the accounting profession, quote, needs to work on its credibility, unquote. You also said, we're going to have to be tougher with our audits. What made you think this?
Well, just what was going on. That whenever there was something would go wrong in a financial statement, the old, where were the auditors question would come up. And the profession itself, this wasn't the firm, because we were fairly fortunate in that we didn't have a lot of lawsuits and the like. But it was clear that the profession was undergone. Congress had looked into them. The Senate had looked into them. Everyone was telling them how what they needed to do. And so credibility was an issue. And so I felt that that was an important part. What was the other part of the question? I said,
We're going to have to be tougher with our audits.
Yeah, well.
So that follows that from that.
Flows from that.
Uh-huh, yep. So were you also thinking about possible mergers at this time? Within 2 years, there was discussion of a merger with Anderson.
I wasn't thinking of it. But again, remember back when the first discussion took place, when the Deloitte thing, I still felt that there was going to be consolidation, that it was unstable, the profession, in terms of these eight firms all trying to stay independent. And then, you know, you began to hear the rumors about Deloitte and Touche and Ernst & Ernst and Arthur Young. And we had actually talked to Deloitte again during those times, very briefly. And the name and the people had changed in the interim, including me, where I was new.
So we
spoke to Anderson. We had agreed to spend a considerable amount of money. And partners, when they spend money, invest money, it doesn't go on the balance sheet. It goes right down to the P&L. So we had already agreed to spend a large amount to beef up our information technology capabilities for a variety of reasons. Then all of a sudden, when we got the call from Anderson, the question was, well, this is an opportunity where we don't have to invest a zillion. They have a huge...
Mm-hmm. Anderson was the strongest in IT services at this time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we felt we were the strongest in auditing based on our clientele and our experience and so on. So it looked like it could be a possibility. But we entered into talks with them. We announced that we were in talks. And then they just didn't work out.
The Justice Department even approved it, I believe.
I don't recall.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
Possible.
Yeah. Okay, at this time, was litigation posing a threat to the accounting industry?
Litigation was always a threat to the accounting
industry. So it didn't just start then?
No. The plaintiff's bar, you know, moves from, you know, they went to asbestos, gone to auditors, you know, they move wherever opportunity lies. And there was a period of time when going after auditors was a hot ticket for them. Mm-hmm. So everyone knew that there was that threat, and when you said you have to be tougher on our audits, and we have to be very, very careful, and we said you have a responsibility to share your big issues with your partners. In other words, the word that came down was don't go it alone. You got a really tough call on an audit, and it's a very difficult and complex situation. Don't go it alone. Well, you have the right, when you become a partner, you pick up that pen and sign Bryce Waterhouse. But this was, share it. A, go down the hall and discuss it with another experienced partner, this is the problem I'm having, here's what I think we might do, and get his or her views on it. Or call research department in the national office, this is the problem we're having. And the research department could look at not only the literature and interpretation, but they could look at numbers of cases of similar situations that were kept in our files, which you could access, and they could say, well, in this case, we handle this problem this way, and maybe you would have. So, but the idea was, just don't go it alone. Make sure you've shared it with a partner. You have that responsibility. We have that responsibility to each other. And I think that was happening, and it worked well for us. Yeah.
There were two big cases in the early 90s that affected Price Waterhouse. One was BCCI. How did this affect the American firm?
Very little. I mean, the only thing we had done on BCCI in the U.S. was we'd done certain work on instructions from the U.K., and there was not a problem with that particular work or the outcome. Or
it was
whatever.
The U.K. firm that had done the auditing of BCCI in Italy.
Pretty much, and I think they had farmed out, depending on location, some of it, but they made the key decisions and so on.
Okay. What about Standard Chartered?
Standard Chartered, that was a bear. I don't want to go into it because it would take me a while. But basically, they had no case. Mm-hmm. Okay? What it was I'll try to make this as brief as I can. They had agreed to buy a bank in Arizona, which was going through an absolute total boom in real estate.
That was United Bancorp.
Yeah, okay, so the lending for real estate was huge. And Standard Chartered, I think, felt at the time that they didn't want to be left out. They wanted in. And so they made an offer, and then nothing really happened. And then they made a bigger offer without doing any more due diligence or anything. And they won with their bigger offer, and they acquired this bank. Well, within 6 months, the bubble of Arizona real estate burst. And up went the loan reserves, and down went the profits, and down went the share prices, what have you. And so Standard Chartered had, again, this happens a lot, had to find a scapegoat, and so we were. And they hired an attorney who was one of the was well reputed in plaintiff's bar circles in Arizona as being one tough cookie. And they sued us, and we had a young staffer, a girl, who this guy in cross-examination had her practically in tears. And so I see how I can recall it. The jury then awarded some huge amount, which would have put us very close to the chapter. And we worked diligently. That was a high point of my time because I had to keep our public face strong, and I continued to make the case that this was an absurd ruling, that it couldn't happen.
It was a $338 million award.
Yeah. And so the judge in the case, just to make it even scarier, who turned out was perfectly fine, but he had gone to the University, I think, of Washington, and he was a gymnast of sorts. He was on a trampoline, and he landed wrong, and he broke his neck and paralyzed himself from the neck down. And so he sued, and he got a settlement, put himself through law school and everything. So now he's a judge, and he was known to be very favorable towards plaintiffs. So that made it particularly scary. And so we appealed that verdict. And all along, I had to keep telling the public that this cannot stand, we will emerge from this. And I did a lot of praying, too. And so I'll never forget the Friday that it came in. They called me, the attorneys from Phoenix, and they said, well, it's over. The case is over. And I said, well, what's the number? And they said, the number is zero. And so...
There was a small party at the Pricewaterhouse office that day?
No, I went to St. Patrick's first way home. But I thought, could this happen? A case that really isn't a case. And our lawyer had told us at the outset, our in-house lawyer, this case, because of the way the trial went, could cost us a few million. And he named a number. And eventually, it never did go back. The judge, when he issued the ruling, throwing out everything, he left one opening that the case could go back again to court. And so that didn't happen. So it was settled for this small amount, and that was the end of it. But it was, the number out there was so big, you know. And I was afraid that we would lose clients or lose partners, and we lost neither. No clients left and no partners left during that period.
So it was a successful case of public relations management.
Yeah, and management of our, not public, but also within the firm.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, by 1992, Pricewaterhouse posted the second highest rise in revenues of the big six accounting firms, right behind Anderson. So you were doing something right.
Yes. I mean, we were doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Great. So how does one become a trustee of the Financial Accounting Foundation?
I have no idea, except I imagine there's a nominating committee from inside, and I was called and asked if I would be willing to serve on the board of the FAF, as mm-hmm. we called it, and I agreed to do so. And it was sort of like you had to say yes because everybody had to take their turn.
Mm-hmm. Did you know Denny Beresford or any of the other FASB board members before you became a trustee?
Yes, I had met Dennis. Who else were members at the time?
Jim Leisenring was.
I didn't know him until then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't have the list of
okay.
them here, but
I'd probably known a couple more.
Yeah. So what was your experience there like? I guess in general terms, what were you expecting before, in terms of duties before when you got the phone?
Well, the biggest, there was two major duties. One was to see that the FASB was funded, and the other was to nominate members to serve on the board. And there was always pushback in the public about the membership, that there were too many bookish, professorial or whatever you types, and we needed more practical people who'd been out there in the trenches and knew what it was all about, new business and new accounting from that angle. But we had good cooperation in naming members, and I don't remember all the ones we named, but they served well.
Okay. Well, let's take those two issues one by one. First, you talked about the finances at the FASB. When you became a trustee, I believe that the FASB was having some financial problems.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a big, terrible
no.
thing, but there was probably a dip in contributions, and so mm-hmm. we pushed hard.
So how did you go about fundraising? Did you just make phone calls? To
yeah. Or wrote and said, you know, how important it was to keep this in the private, mm-hmm. self-regulatory cycle, and companies responded pretty much.
Was there ever any...
And the firms mm-hmm. also, the accounting firms also mm-hmm. stepped up.
Yeah. Was there ever any concern about the FASB possibly suffering a drop in operations because of the funding issue? Or
no, not to my recollection, not at all.
Okay. And in terms of selecting board members, how did you go about the selection process?
FASB members?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Anybody could nominate people or suggest people, you know. And so you had a list of people, and you you'd have some typically retired partners from accounting firms. You could have active or retired financial executives from industry, or you could have academics. Mm-hmm. And so you usually got the nominations, consider them, and then you looked at the balance of who was on the board, and then, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know at the time there were some newspaper articles about Arthur Northrop, who was on the board, who was up for a second term and then was not invited to serve for a second term. Do you remember what happened there?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't even remember that he was denied a second term.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
I just have no recollection of that.
Yeah. Perhaps that might have been overblown in the news reports also. So. Yeah.
Yeah. For all I know, he might have just stepped down.
Mm-hmm. Right. Also, in 1990, the trustees voted to change the voting procedures at the FASB to 5-2 rather than just a simple majority. Do you recall that decision?
I do. I do recall that. And I was very much in favor of changing that. I said, putting forth here are what we call our generally accepted accounting principles, meaning these principles have fairly wide acceptance within the community that relies on them and that has to enforce them. And I said, 4-3 does not imply that kind of support. And I thought 5-2, I don't know if I brought it up first, but I was strongly in favor of it. And I thought it makes a lot of sense, because then you could say this is definitely something that has wide acceptance, and therefore it's a generally accepted accounting principle.
Were there any standards that you were particularly concerned about that had been passed on a 4-3 basis, or was it more the principle of the matter?
It was more the principle of the matter. And there might have been, but I have no recollection of which one I would single out as being a bad one.
But right.
And no, none of them were that bad anyway.
Mm-hmm. At this time, there was consideration of a number of standards on financial instruments. Do you recall the debate over that at the time?
Well, I recall there was a debate, and more mostly the issue was to have more current mm-hmm. current market
right.
reflected in the carrying
market
value.
How involved were trustees in the FASB's day-to-day work? Did they ever call and say, "Hey, we're considering this issue. What do you all think about this?"
Never. They were truly independent, and if I had called one of them, they never called us. If I had called one of them and said, "Hey, I think you ought to," they would have just hung up the phone. No, mm-hmm. they were truly independent. There was no attempt to interfere with their work or to influence them on the part of the FASB. Now, I'm speaking of myself. Mm-hmm. I can't say for certain that, no, I don't think anyone else would have, but it's possible someone on an isolated basis might have. But I would be very surprised if I heard that.
Mm-hmm. Artie, at this time, there's also a lot of talk about the issue of auditor independence. One proposal in 1991 from the Comptroller General was to require the nation's 50 biggest banks to switch accounting firms every 5 or 7 years. What did you think about this?
I didn't think it was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
We did a study, I don't know who did the study, but we were interested in it, showed that when auditors change of large enterprises, errors frequently occur in the first 2 years following the change. And that is, I know one case where, I don't know what bank, it was a bank that we were replaced by somebody else, and the next year they had to pull back and restate their accounts. It's very hard to get your arms around a large, complex enterprise, and the first year is particularly difficult. You have to invest a huge amount of time and money because You're not going to get paid for every your learning curve totally. And often it can extend into the second year. And it's a torture to the companies themselves. The amount of management time that you tie up when you go in there. So making a change ought to be done from time to time in the right circumstances. Mm-hmm. But to have a mandatory required change, I think, is a bad idea. I've said, and I may have even testified to this, that look, this happens every year. The audit committee has to make a decision. You issue a proposal each year for the next year's audit. And if they have the right to change or to say, let's invite somebody else in, and I assume that happens from time to time. So really, it's not as if that isn't going to happen unless you do this. So,
right.
Okay. So no, I didn't think it was a good idea to make it mandatory, because you could have a very good running audit, a good relationship, and you could just foul it up by forcing change.
This is a perennial issue in public policy and accounting.
Yes, and will continue to be. Mm-hmm. There's always somebody who says, just make them change every few years.
Right. I want to read you a quote from Donald Kirk in 1991, if it's okay. Many groups view the board, and it's talking about the FASB, as fair game for lobbying. It has become part of our way of life, and it seems a bit unfortunate when it goes to the extent it is going on with regard to the FASB. Do you think that's a fair assessment? But there's a lot of lobbying that goes on.
Well, it depends how you describe lobbying. Mm-hmm. But what would happen? They would take up an issue, and they would issue some kind of a preliminary discussion paper or something like that, and encourage people to respond. Mm-hmm. And so people would respond, particularly if their toe was stepped on in the discussion. And then in the draft of what's going to be the new principle would come out, and the same thing would happen. And if you call that lobbying. Now, lobbying sometimes, I think, went to extreme, and I think I mentioned to you over the phone that President Clinton wrote to the FASB at one time about the option pricing, you know, requiring that to go against income. So the lobbying phone calls to the as we probably happened. Mm-hmm. They never complained to us, not that we would have done anything about it.
Did people ever complain to you? Did you get phone calls?
No, but when I was chairman of the FAF, one of the things I always did, given my belief that client service was number one, I would visit our major clients throughout the country and indeed some throughout the world, over a period of time. And so I interviewed the first 100 clients going around, and someone said, what are you going to do when you get done that? I said, I'm going to start over again. But when I would do that, during that time, I would say, by the way, I'm chairman of the Financial Accounting Foundation, and we help to fund through yours and others' contributions, and appoint members of the FASB. Is there anything you'd like to tell me about your view of the situation? And by and large, they were pretty docile. You know, they'd say, well, you know, it's a difficult situation, and, you know, I'm sure you guys are doing the best you can, and I don't like this particular FASB, but there's nothing I could do about that anyway. So, but one time, I went... and a very tough, this guy was well known as a tough critter, and he said, I'll tell you what I would do if I were you. And I said, what's that? He said, I would get a bulldozer, and he said, I'd just bury that outfit up at Stanford, which is, I said, oh, okay, thanks for your comment. That was the end of that. But that was it. I got that, but other than that, it was mainly just sort of, well, it's life, you know, we got to have rules and regs, and you know.
Was that person angry about the issue of stock options?
No. He said no. No, that was had nothing to do. He was just a general. He was one of these he governs best, who governs least type of guys, you know. Yeah. No, it had nothing to do with options.
Right. No, options did become an issue probably at the end of your term there.
at the FAF. Yeah. Oh, well, that was a hot issue, and I'm sure that Don Kirk felt the heat of the opposition to that.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, in your final 2 years at Price Waterhouse, how did you prepare to leave? I guess prepare to turn over the business.
Well, I felt that that the profession, as looking at the major firms, that was still unstable, and that there was bound to be another. You already had the two mergers, and there was bound to be more. And so I wanted to leave the firm, and I had stated this, that A, this firm's name should remain forevermore. It's the most important and recognized name in the profession. And second, my successor should become the CEO of whomever we merge with. And I said, to do that, to be sure of that, we have to make sure our client base is firm, make sure it's growing, and make sure that our earnings are. And those things happen, and the name remained, and my successor became CEO of the merged firm.
Had there been any talks with Liburan and Coopers during your time as senior partner about a possible merger, or did that come later?
Yes. About the time we were talking to Anderson, and, you know, mm-hmm. we talked to Deloitte again before they mm-hmm. tied the knot. And yes, there had been. Mm-hmm. But the feeling was maybe we'd be better off in terms of we already have this great audit base and we have this great, you know. Mm-hmm. It just didn't work out. But no, we talked to everybody just about, you know. We talked to Coopers and we talked to Anderson. I don't know if anyone else was left. Well, Pete's had already gone mm-hmm. into the Kleinfeld firm over in the K of KPMG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after you left Price Waterhouse, what did you do?
Well, I thought about what am I going to do, and I'll tell you one thing I did. When I first became chairman, I had felt that public relations, and we had an outstanding public relations firm. I can't remember his name at the moment, but I went and told him it's not about me, because my predecessor's name was often in the papers, and I said, it's not about me, it's about Price Waterhouse. I don't need great publicity for me, so let's turn it to the firm. And so when I was leaving, as I told you, I'm not sure what your question was.
Yeah. What you did after you left the firm.
Okay. So, as a result, I was out of sight from everybody down here that I'd known for many years as an auditor and as a partner and as the guy in charge of the practice. I was totally divorced from Philadelphia. They said I could have an office in Philadelphia or New York. I thought, get away from New York, because I don't want to be seen to be stepping on the toes of my predecessor or questioning him. So I came back here. But first, about a month before retirement, I came down and I called on like five people that I'd known, and I said, I'm coming back and I'll be available. So that was about it. And each one of them recommended me for a board or for some involvement in the community and so on. And so
you didn't have any trouble finding things to do?
No.
Okay.
No, it went gradually, but yes.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come to be asked by the Public Oversight Board to chair their panel on audit effectiveness?
Well, I can't be sure what all their deliberations were, but I got a call I can't remember from whom, but it was one of the senior members of the POB and told me about the project and that they had thought I would be a good chairman and would I do it. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a worthwhile thing, and I thought I could do it, and I had an excellent staff, as it turned out, to carry it out.
Tell me about your staff. How big was your staff?
Well, we had about five or six people, and then there were some loaners from some of the firms. Dave Pearson, he was the staff director, and he was a retired E&Y partner. And then there was George Fritz from Cooper's, Ed Noonan from KPMG, and Tom Stemler from Arthur Anderson. They were all full-time, if you will, staff. And then the firms all lent another, like, 12 people for individual particular tasks, or they might accompany on the quasi peer reviews and the like. So it was a good team that we had.
Now, the panel was convened at the request of SEC. Chairman Arthur Leavitt. Did you know him personally?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Did he pick you, or do you think it was the POB that
did? POB did.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Did you already know the other members of the panel before you started?
I knew some of them. I knew Ralph Saul and Zovana Palmrose and I also knew Paul Colton. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
Did you pick the members of the panel, or
no.
Was it the PLB that did it?
No. They picked them.
Before you agreed to chair the group, did you already believe that there was a problem with the audit model as it had evolved over the previous years?
Well, there's always some problem with the model. There's always issues, and as time change, and as the runaway growth of IT, there's always going to be issues facing the profession. And I just thought, the SEC was coming down hard and speaking out, and something like this was needed to try and deal with the issues that were being brought up. And so it made sense.
Did the panel choose the agenda items itself, or were they given to it? And I'm talking about issues like that they dealt with, like the question of independent auditors' responsibilities, the audit methodology.
Yeah, we chose them, and and some of these things had been spoken about or recommended either by the SEC or by others. So we talked to everybody you could imagine that had an interest, and gleaned all of that and made our decisions about what we thought needed to be addressed. So.
At the outset of the project, did you expect that it would take 2 years?
I wasn't sure how long it would take, but did it take 2 years?
I think the report was issued in 2000, and the panel started in 98, so...
Well, August of 2000, we issued our final report. The FAO was formed the end of 98.
Okay.
So we probably didn't convene. We wrote in January of 99 what we were doing, and then we started the public hearing. So it was probably maybe a year and a half. And no, I hadn't thought exactly how much time it would take, but that particular timetable didn't upset me as it developed.
Okay, and so in terms of methodology, the report used a variety of different techniques. First, you had these quasi-peer reviews. How did you go about selecting the audits that you would look at for these?
Well, we just made sure that we covered every firm and different industries and the like. We couldn't review audits that were in litigation. Mm-hmm. But other than that, we made our choices.
So did you have your pick of any audit that had been performed by a firm registered with the Regs Committee, or how did you go about selecting which ones you would in particular work on? I mean, did the firm say, well, we have these audits you can work on?
No.
Okay.
No.
Yeah.
We chose them.
Yeah.
We chose different offices, and we chose different clients of those offices.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it was done.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was completely sort of, if I may say so, random, except that we wanted to make sure we covered certain industries and the like.
Okay. Yeah. What about the survey? How did you go about choosing individuals and organizations that would fill out the survey?
I just can't recall, but I know it was done very systematically to get the best possible coverage and the widest, the broadest, if you will, participation.
Okay. So in general, the final report seemed to praise the auditing process with a couple of major exceptions. What critiques did it have of the auditing process?
Well, always, you know, if you look at the quasi peer reviews, there were some areas where they said, but you know, in 10% of the cases, there was inadequate follow up of this or that. So there was criticisms that needed to be addressed and needed to be tightened up. But yeah, the general outlook was, of all the audits that we looked at, there was none that they said, whoa, this was wrong, you shouldn't have issued the opinion or anything like that. In other words, in most cases, they got good grades for doing the work, following up, and reporting. So that's, and we didn't say it's great, we just said it's serving the needs, mm-hmm. doing, but it can always be improved, and that will always be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. If you wanted to have a perfect audit, it would cost like 10 times as much as it now costs. Mm-hmm. There has to be some acceptable level of risk in this equation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. One of the things the report did is to call for a forensic-type fieldwork phase in which the managers were presumed to be dishonest. Had anything like this been attempted before?
No, not as a systematic part mm-hmm. of audits. If you had a particular issue, you might. But I was very strongly in favor of that. That was where you sat down, you and your staff sat down at the outset or before the outset and said, if you were going to game the numbers or you were going to try and hype, do this or that, how would you go about it based on our accumulated audit knowledge of this company? What area would you head into? What things would you tinker with,
mm-hmm.
And with a fair chance of getting away? And then so from that, you could say, well, what can we do
mm-hmm.
to test? I had a great concern throughout this process, and it's what we eventually called linkage, and it's discussed there several times. Because I had seen instances in my career where people would check out the internal controls, you know, and write them all up, answer all the questionnaires, maybe issue a memo suggesting improvement. And risk management, identifying all the risks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then the linkage to testing that was going to be done wasn't always established clearly, in my view. In other words, if you had a number of internal control weaknesses, were you going to hit harder in that particular area? It wasn't always the linkage, you know. In some cases, I think it would be fair to say it was almost divorced from, in other words, guys wanted to do what they wanted to do in terms of the substantive testing,
mm-hmm.
And were not necessarily influenced by the risk profile or the, but I hope that one of the results of this, that the links between those two processes and the work that's undertaken is very strong today.
Was there any opposition to including this phase in the audit? Did anyone say, oh, that's not necessary, or we don't want that because it's not necessary to...
No, well, the typical thing would be, oh, it's going to cost us more money. You know, that was... Mm-hmm. No one, and of course some companies, and understandably, would say, you know, like, we're all good, honest people, and we don't do anything like that. You know, so there's a natural human resistance. But the only spoken resistance would be, this is going to cost more money. But yet another overhead cost of regulation.
Mm-hmm. But what about the issue of auditor independence? What did the panel have to say about that?
Well, we had two things to say, that ban and no ban. And so I would say it was pretty much evenly divided, except it was probably a little more on the side of no ban, but watchful and involvement of the audit committee and so on. So I should say that this panel was advertised at the outset as a totally independent panel. Mm-hmm. But the three members who were on our panel were put there by the SEC, and the others were put there by the POB. Well, the SEC said, no, we don't want to do this. They were originally, people said, why don't you do that? They said, no, we want an independent body. But they tried very hard, I don't want to go into it, to influence the outcome of everything that we did. Mm-hmm. And they were not ultimately necessarily successful in that. But because members became concerned about the SEC having a pipeline into the... Mm-hmm. I went to visit them because I had to visit the SEC from time to time. And I remember I asked the chief accountant, or he asked me, well, how's it going? I said, you tell me. And he laughed. Mm-hmm. They tried very hard to influence the outcome, particularly of that issue. They wanted us to recommend the ban, so they didn't have to do it.
Mm-hmm. The SEC had already taken measures a little bit before this, right? The Independent Standards Board had been set up in 1997 and was already dealing with this issue. How did you feel about the Independent Standards Board?
I thought it was good. I thought it was... I liked the idea of focusing on independence in that way and having a separate independent body looking at independence.
Mm-hmm. So the audit panel conducted these quasi-peer reviews on 37 different engagements and noted that in none of them had the provision of both audit and non-audit services hurt the audit. And in one quarter of the cases, it had actually improved them. Mm-hmm. How did it improve them?
Well, most of the engagements, probably in those days, most of the management services engagements involved IT. And so they're in doing an IT thing, and then they're telling you, this is what we recommend. And you could learn, you were learning more about the intricacies of the system, which could make you a better auditor. It's one of the reasons that I was against a ban, because I thought we could lose a lot of our specialists who we need on the audits. If we say you can't do this work, then did they want to stay just to be on audits? Well, they've managed to recruit successfully a number of people as it is now who specialize in IT but do audits or else are involved in audits.
Were there any kind of non-audit services that should have been banned for firms that were providing audit services?
Yes, well, and they have been, you know. So yeah. One of them was recruiting, I believe. That is, you know, some firms were acting as a recruiter for positions that probably typically financial services jobs, but mm-hmm. things like that. You could, and basically, you know, I like a short and simple rule, and that is you can't audit your own work. Mm-hmm. You start with that as your as your basic philosophy. I think you can solve a lot of problems.
Yeah. The panel also looked at the overall governance structure of the accounting profession. What did the report have to say about that?
Well, we wanted to strengthen the POB and enlarge its scope. And basically, of course, the POB is no longer. Mm-hmm. And it's been replaced by the PCAOB.
Mm-hmm. The Peekaboo.
Yeah, Peekaboo, which has some of the powers. But the demise of the Anderson firm, I think, has hurt in this, in that with four firms, I think the PCAOB is part of its responsibility is to make sure those four firms survive. You know, it's a difficult, difficult situation with only four firms that are capable of handling the major audits with international scope. There's a strengthening of the mid-sized firms and national firms, if you will. But I don't see one becoming comparable to the four major firms, to be honest.
At the time,
that's mm-hmm. a problem when you're just trying to oversee or regulate four firms.
At the time that the panel was doing its work, did the SEC express an opinion on what it thought the governing structure of the accounting industry should be?
They did not hesitate to express their opinion on any subject, including that.
Mm-hmm. Also, within the panel, in terms of the board members, or the panel members?
Yeah, we didn't always agree right at the outset on any subject. Right. But we talked them out, discussed them, looked at the quasi-peer reviews.
So some panel members were pushing for the panel to call for a public organization to oversee the accounting industry?
You mean like the PCAOB?
Right. Was that happen? Was anyone within the panel?
Well, it was strengthening the POB and it had more public members on this board and that board and mm-hmm. a majority of public people in the independent Senate. So it was moving in that direction. I don't know, and it could have been, but I don't remember anyone saying, we need a totally public entity to do this.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, of course, within 2 years after this report was issued, the POB dissolved itself. Why do you think that the confidence in the POB declined?
I'm not sure I accept it. Maybe the SEC's confidence in the POB declined, but I thought they were doing the best they possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And we recommended that their powers and responsibilities be expanded.
Okay. Yep. What did the report have to say about international auditing standards?
Well, it pretty much said we have to reach out to the mm-hmm. international bodies and get them on board with some of these reforms.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing has happened with accounting principles. It's a very difficult sale. And everyone intellectually can agree that we should have just one set of standards globally. But the water's edge is a big determinant in that. In different countries, the accounting principles are set for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily a fair presentation, but how to come up with a tax.
Right.
So we couldn't get too deeply involved in that because you're talking about 30 or 40 rulemaking bodies around the world, all with different thoughts and ideas.
All you could do is note the importance of it.
So. Yeah. And suggest a greater level of cooperation.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So a good number of the panel's recommendations actually found their way in, or at least turned into were implemented in one way or another. One of them was the adoption of SAS 99, Consideration of Fraud in a Financial Statement Audit. Did you feel that that accurately reflected the intentions of the panel?
I think so. You know, that's a good point. I was going to suggest maybe it's 10 years now. Maybe someone should take this and say, and write up, here's a good doctoral thing. Mm-hmm. What's been done and what's been not been done.
That sounds like a pretty worthy project, actually. Yeah, be interesting to see. Yeah. So at the public hearings that you held on this report, and I know that you held another, were there any surprises that came up?
No, but there were some suggestions that we incorporated before and changed the report. If we felt that that was a good suggestion and something that we should be doing. So I don't remember the details of each suggestion that we then modified, but we did. So it wasn't like we were just doing these to make it look like we were interested. We really were interested, and we really did respond to the questions and issues that were raised by the respondents.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. Well, do you have any other thoughts on the O'Malley panel, or should we move on?
No, I think it was a good group. I think it was very diligent. They were very sincere in their effort to improve, and the staff was excellent, and I think we came up with a very good product. I would stand behind this report even today, and I would like to find out the degree to which it has been implemented. Of course, strengthening the POB isn't being done, but you could say, well, maybe the PCAOB is covering a lot of the ground that you wanted the POB to do.
It's not exactly recent, but there was a GAO report published 2 years after that that looked at the implementation of the recommendations. Of course, not much time had elapsed.
Right.
And there have been a number of other changes, like, you know, like the creation of the PCAOB. But it's an interesting read, certainly. Moving on, pretty soon after the panel issued this report, you had an outbreak of other scandals that were in some way or another related to accounting, WorldCom and Enron, for instance. Did these events make you rethink any of your other positions about accounting?
No. In other words, they should have been caught with the normal audit procedures No, I didn't think this meant that there was something wrong with either accounting or auditing. There was obviously something wrong with the audits involved, but that didn't mean that the rules for auditing needed to be changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In March 2002, you testified to the Senate Finance Committee about a wide variety of failures that led to the Enron collapse. How was that experience?
I was really concerned about the Enron collapse. It was such a... Some of the things I couldn't believe that I heard. And we went over it very carefully, and I could find a lot of things that should not have stood or should not have been done. But in the final analysis, the reaction to that was totally beyond what was necessary. Arthur Andersen is a fine firm with a good reputation. And how they allowed this to happen is beyond me, but they shouldn't have taken maybe a handful of partners and take them out behind the barn. But mm-hmm. I mean, to take down a whole firm, thousands of honest, hardworking, effective auditors, is just totally over the top in terms of reaction. And it hurt the profession to have to get down to four firms.
Mm-hmm. So you think the profession was healthier when there were more firms?
Up to a point, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, five or six would be fine, because there's enough diversity there, and if you're choosing an auditor, you have a good selection. Nowadays, most companies have relationships with at least two or three of these four firms. You know, they have some of them doing this, some of them doing that. So they know people in each of the firm and have dealt with them. And if they ever need to make a change, they know something about the culture of the firm and everything. So it would be better if there was a couple more, you know.
Okay. So in your testimony, you reemphasized your belief that the mandatory rotation of auditing firms was not necessary.
Yeah, I'm still there. I think that could cause more problems than it solves.
Yeah. So around this time, you also started serving on other corporate boards. You were a member of the board at Freddie Mac as well.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And when did you start on the board of directors there?
I don't remember, but it was not long after that we encountered the problem. And we brought in a prominent attorney, James Doty, who had been an SEC either chief counsel or a commissioner, I forget. And he oversaw the audit, and then we had to, the conclusion was that we needed to remove about four people.
Mm-hmm. How was the problem discovered? I think, had Anderson been their auditor before?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know whether maybe Pricewaterhouse replaced them. I don't know if they discovered it. I think they probably did. Mm-hmm. And then we immediately turned to to Doty. And what had happened was one of the senior people had changed something in their report, you know, which should not have been changed, the wording. And it wasn't that major a change why he felt the need to do that, let's be honest. But in any event, that led to more and more investigation. And when the four people were either encouraged to leave or outright fired. And of course, the CEO at the time was also the chairman of the board. And so we had to replace all these. And so they said, well, that's when I was asked to become chairman. Mm-hmm. And I think because I was the most newest member of the board, probably least aware of what might have been going on. I don't think anyone was, but I mean, and that may be facetious to say, they asked me to do it because I was the newest member, but I agreed to do it for a short period. And I felt, given that there had to be significant testimony by the new fellow before Congress and so on, he should be made again chairman and senior partner instead of having a separation.
Now, this was a case where an auditing problem was discovered during a rotation of the auditing firm. Do you think that's evidence that maybe the rotation of auditing firms is a good thing?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I have my opinions about the audits, but I don't want to go into that.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. So there was a report by James Doty and Baker Botts over the summer, and then some people were pushed out. What was the SEC doing during this time? Were they involved at all?
We were not subject to the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one thing that troubled me a little. I had worked with clients, innumerable clients over my career that were under SEC. And I thought that actually strengthened your situation in the marketplace. In fact, you were an SEC registrant. But there was some, I mean, including the senior management or senior guy didn't feel we should register with the SEC. And that worried me a little. I thought, you know, and it did, I guess it made it easier or something, but I mean, and that was our goal right up to the time that I retired from the board, was to get registered with the SEC. And it didn't happen. I mean, I left and
you left in 2008?
In May.
Yeah. So the government regulator at the time that this was happening was the OFHEO, the Office of, the Federal Housing?
OFEO.
Yeah. Did they have requirements that were similar to the SEC?
I would say no. I mean, they... That's an entirely different role than regulating your financial reporting and everything. They basically were supposed to oversee our, you know, liquidity and whether we were doing our mission and that sort of thing. But it wasn't so much that they did come in and look at the accounts, and they had people come and interview people and the like that. But they only regulated two companies, Freddie and Fannie. It was kind of a weird regulatory situation. And it was political to some degree, in that the way I heard it, the fellow who was in charge of OFEO when I was there had been put in there under a Democratic administration. And when the problems surfaced that resulted in the firings and everything, it was assumed that, and I think then the Republicans came in, that they would put in their thing. But then the way the back door, you know, was, no, they figure the Democrats put that guy in there, let him stew. I don't know what, you know, but I mean, it was politics was very much a part of that scene. And then they brought in a new regulator.
The Federal Housing Finance Agency?
No. OFEO had a new guy come in.
Okay.
He was brought in. He was put in by the Bush administration.
Okay. When you left the board in 2008, had the new oversight body already been created, the Federal Housing Finance Agency?
No.
No. Okay, so you left prior to that. Okay, do you think that the current economic crisis has anything to do with accounting and accounting standards, or is it a business issue? What is it?
No, I don't think you can attribute the current crisis to accounting standards. I mean, could accountants have prevented it? No, I don't think so. I think there's always a feeling when something goes wrong to blame the auditors and not those who were doing whatever they were doing. I think I went into this thinking, if it's our national policy that everybody should own a home, then this is a good thing. And if everyone would believe that everybody owned their own home, we'd probably have a lot less crime and a lot less this, that. So on the paper, it looks like a good thing. And at one point, we said, or our CEO said, we were mission-driven. And it was. Most of the people there who believed in the mission of trying to have liquidity in the marketplace for mortgages and to encourage home ownership. So the push from the political side to make it more and more and more and more available to the low end eventually had these so-called affordable housing issues, which was people were getting houses that probably the odds of their paying back the mortgage got longer and longer, I think.
So the root of the problem was probably political.
Yeah, to some degree. I mean, I'm not saying it was wrong to want to put everybody in the house, but to do away with underwriting standards, pressing the underwriting standards beyond almost to the breaking point was part of the problem.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to finish up with a couple of final general questions. Some accountants feel that the industry needs to move towards more
personal. It's not an industry. It's a profession.
Excuse me. The profession needs to move towards principles-based accounting, while others feel that auditors need very specific guidelines. Where do you fit on the scale?
I'm a principles-based guy, with judgment being brought to bear by the professionals in the profession. Sometimes they claim that we're not rule-based, we're principles-based. So I said, how can you have an 182-page principle? You know, and I've overstated the issue. For example, in leasing alone, we have like several hundred pages of rules. And someone said, well, how would you change it? I said, I would just have one rule. What's that? Property subject to a lease should appear on one, but only one, balance sheet. start with that and work off that.
It's very, very, very broad-based rule.
But it's fairly simple.
Mm-hmm. Right. Fair enough. So how do you see the role of the SEC?
The SEC has an important role and gives a lot of credibility to the whole financial reporting process and to the markets themselves and to the willingness of investors to invest in companies that are regulated by the SEC. I think the SEC for many years played a very good, neutral, uncontroversial role. And I think of some of the lions of the SEC, especially in the accounting side, Carmen Blau, I think, might have been the original chief accountant. I think of Andy Barr, of Clarence Sampson. These guys were well known and respected, and you could go to them with a problem and come to a reasonable solution. I think it's become more under political pressures over the years. And I think that's unfortunate, that it should be viewed as totally independent and not leaning towards this or that. And you see now there's three of this party and two of that party of the commission. And for once, you have split votes. It used to be they pretty much unanimously approved things, even though their appointments might have come from different administrations. It's got to go back to being purely professional and independent, and with the investor mm-hmm. and his safety in mind.
Well, sounds like good advice. What what advice would you give to young people interested in a career in an accounting firm?
Well, it's still a little unstable. I think I would say go in with the assumption that you'll move on after 5 years. You can learn an awful lot in 4 or 5 years. Now, you may say, well, maybe I could become a partner. I used to talk to people that were coming into the profession, and I'd say, what's your ambition? And they would say, I want to be a partner in a firm like this. And I would say, no. First, you want to become a CPA. Second, goal should be to become a senior accountant. I said, just take steps and then keep open your options. Maybe you'll go out and leave and do this and do that. But
maybe they thought you wanted to hear them say it.
Maybe they did, yeah.
But,
yeah.
Okay, do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, just I welcome the opportunity. It's been 15 years since I've been in the firm and active in the profession, and it's probably been about 22 years since I signed a set of accounts for an SEC registrant. So my memory isn't what it used to be, but I appreciate the opportunity, and I thank you for coming here and doing it.
Well, we thank you for talking with us today.
Okay.